Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Today I'm here talking to Paul. How you doing, Paul?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. We have a few sort of setup issues getting this correct, you know, exactly right audio, exactly right video, but that's part of the fun of having macOS Big Sur, right?
Yeah, joys of software.
I really hope that the next iMac Pro, whatever they choose, next iMac, whatever redesign they do, will have a decent 1080p camera, because the iMac Pro is the only one that has a 1080p webcam. Yeah. We're going to have a USB-C webcam, an external microphone, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a lot of hassle. I just want to talk to someone nicely and clearly and, you know, good sound.
Yeah, I'm lazy. I just use whatever, I guess it's a 720 in the MacBook Pros.
It is. I know. It's embarrassing. That even like the newest one from, you know, a month or two ago, the M1s are still 720p. That's the best they can do. You think, come on, they've had like 9 months of pandemic now. They know how bad these webcams look. They should be planning ahead slightly more to get them upgraded.
They're using machine learning. It looks better, doesn't it? I don't know.
That's such a weak excuse. If machine learning made it better, make all Macs have better webcams with that, you know? Machine learning is available on all these things, surely.
I didn't even realize, I guess, they had 1080 in Max, but you said it's only on the iMac Pro.
Is now, what, 3 years old, the MacBook iMac Pro?
Yeah.
They haven't bumped it in quite a while, have they? It was the early original one, the black one came out, like, ooh, and nothing since, basically. They've bumped it slightly, but no actual redesign or refresh.
Yeah. Maybe they will come out with a Mac M1 iMac Pro, or maybe they'll just ditch it altogether.
Oh, I would like that so much. Yeah, possible. If the iMac generally is so screamingly fast, they might go, there's no point having an iMac Pro anymore. Just keep the Mac Pro for that level of user. We'll see, but, you know, take my money either way. Either one's good.
Yeah, got to be careful with the spending on Apple stuff.
It's all about making shares go up. That's the key. Support the Apple employees with the share schemes and so forth.
Exactly. Didn't you get a M1 Mac? You said on Twitter you got one, didn't you?
I did, yeah, for my daughter, yeah. She's been using that for her work at school.
Did she do any, like, coding or video or any more serious, like, processor intensive stuff?
Well, she does do coding. Not on her Mac currently. She uses other stuff for that. She's just recently got the Lego Mindstorms robot building box. She loves that. But, yeah, she normally does a lot of Python or Scratch. So Swift, she uses a little bit, but not vast amounts, and she prefers to use the iPad for that. So we'll see. But the thing is, it's a MacBook Pro M1. It's going to last her 3 or 4 years. She does all her homework on it right now, and it's extraordinarily powerful, very quick, super long battery life, instant on. It's a great, great laptop.
Nice. My kids did, I think a couple, or maybe it was December, code.org was doing like 4 days of like an hour of code. And Idaho STEM, the state I'm in, was doing like giveaways. If you like, you know, at the end, I guess they give you a certificate. So my kids were doing like the block code stuff, and they actually won a Raspberry Pi 3. So for Christmas, we got them all the pieces to put it together, because it was just, you know, the board.
Yeah.
And I was trying to tell them, I'm like, you can code on this thing. It's even got an editor.
Yeah, Raspberry Pi is a remarkable machine. Have you seen the new keyboard version they've made?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
I was like, ooh, that'd be cool. And then when it came, I was like, ooh, it's tiny. And it was just the board. So, but I was still excited.
The unit. Yeah, of course. You try and get them excited is more challenging, but you can be excited as you like.
It came pre-installed with Minecraft on it. And so my son found that, and now he's playing that. I'm like, oh, okay.
It's the old version. It's like Java Minecraft, isn't it? The ancient Minecraft.
Probably. I don't really know much about it, but my son, he's like showing me he's got tunnels and tree forts and all kinds of crazy stuff. I'm like, wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Minecraft's good no matter what. I think it's because it's the original Java version, which is like a long time ago. All the fancy new stuff they've made since then for the console versions isn't available. So you'll find this out when he demands the more powerful version soon enough, you know?
Yeah. I've been pretty impressed with it, how small it is, and it's still doing games and other stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, it's a great device.
When I was putting together some questions for you, I know you do a little bit different than a lot of the developers I talk to kind of have like a normal like 9-to-5 job, but you've been doing teaching now for, I think I found your stuff 4 or 5 years ago. So you've been teaching Swift now for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, I started writing out Swift the year Swift launched.
Oh, okay, nice.
Yeah, so I wasn't hanging around. I forget the exact registration date of the site, but it was 2016, something or other. I'm sure you can look it up if you look on like Whois Swift.com or something. Nice. But yeah, it's been a little while now of hacking with Swift, and I think it's going pretty well.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love it. I've been using it for years. But
oh, there you go. It's 2014 November.
November, okay.
Yeah, that's when I bought the domain. So I was writing beforehand. I thought, okay, I've got to decide what I'm going to call this. And instead of why I thought hacking with Swift. I don't know what, a terrible name or something. But I thought that'd be a good choice for here. And I went with that. And yeah, so it was, that's 5 months after Swift, you know, ever announced in beta one. And you know, 2 months after the final GM shipped. And I was there on day one with it. I actually made a Safari a extension in Swift, and Swift 1 available on launch for the App Store. Mm-hmm. With when Swift was available. Yeah, I've been on it since day one. I love Swift a lot. So I'm sort of hooked on it now.
Yeah. Is it similar to anything else you've used, or was it, because back then you had Objective-C for iOS, but you're pretty familiar with a lot of programming languages. Was it just really new and you're like, that's exciting looking, or like, this is more similar to something you liked as a like language features?
It was very, very similar to Objective-C back then. Mm-hmm. I know obviously they had, you know, generics and closures and yada, yada, yada. They had a lot of things that Objective-C either had in small amounts, like blocks or closures, or, you know, type inference was new as well. But because it was still all the old API names, string by replacing string or something, you know, all very long method names before Swift 3 came along, it was a very, very easy hop from Objective-C to Swift. Mm-hmm. As long as you didn't try and, you know, poke the very, very new parts too hard, it was perfectly fine. And of course, because it was a language change rather than a framework change, all the frameworks were immediately available. Core Graphics or SpriteKit or SceneKit or WebKit, you name it, they were all there from day one, for better or for worse. And it took a few iterations of Swift to go back and refine those APIs to have the new Swifty Core Graphics API, for example, or the new Swifty Core Image API, to make those better. And that's actually still happening, of course, with Swift 5.4 or 5.5 coming async, or Swift 6 perhaps, but async. They're going back mm-hmm. and changing all the APIs again to have async support. So it's still evolving, but it was good to have everything at the front and just noodle around basically and have fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, but back at that time, I had made like one or two very, very, very basic things with Objective-C and was not enjoying it, like the language. I love Apple and stuff, and that's why I chose that originally. But when I remember watching it, and they're like, oh, what if we had Objective-C without all the baggage? And they're like, Swift. And I'm like, ooh.
What if they had Objective-C without the objective? That's the line.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was pretty awesome.
It was huge. I mean, I don't think anyone saw it coming. I mean, we'd all watched Objective-C get better. You know, we'd seen 2.0 come in with properties and then removing the synthesized stuff and then Arc happening and whatever. There were lots of improvements to Objective-C happening. Every year, or every 2 years at the very least, some major thing would happen to Objective-C to make it better. I think most, if not all of us, thought, wow, this has got a really good future. Mm-hmm. We're seeing massive improvements here. And the problem with Objective-C, ultimately, it's like TypeScript. It's a superset of something else. And so you always, always, always have the something else lagging behind you being horrible. You always have the at symbols and the stars in all the hash imports going on, header files and implementation files. There's always something there that's required to work with the C underbelly, or in TypeScript's case, the JS underbelly. And even though it was getting better, there's only so much lipstick you can put on that particular pig until you realize we've got to fundamentally change something here. And I guess at some point, Apple must start thinking, hey, how can we get a real coding system that everyone can actually use, that beginners want to learn, mm-hmm. that kids wouldn't feel terrified by? And that's why I guess when they had Swift.
Chris Lattner at one point, didn't he say something? I thought he started working on it back in 2010 or something.
Yeah, about then. Yeah, exactly. It took quite a while.
Yeah.
But it got there in the end. That's the main thing. It took him a few years to announce it, 4 years, but that's, you know, making a new thing from scratch. And of course, he had to make lots of Objective-C changes and runtime changes along the way to prepare for Swift to come along. And yeah, obviously, it's been a blast since then, right?
Yeah. I absolutely love it. I think it definitely helped me out of my programming career.
What were you doing beforehand?
Like retail and random jobs.
I just did random stuff. So it was your first language then, your first coding language?
Objective-C was. I started looking at Objective-C back in, I think 2009. So,
Okay.
but I knew absolutely nothing about programming. And in 2014, I had finally said, "Ah, Swift, I'm done with Objective-C." And then I decided I wanted to get a job in tech. I was like, because at that point I was married, and my wife's like, "Why don't you just get a job as a programmer?" I'm like, "Well, how do you do that?" And then everyone's like, "No, you shouldn't do mobile; it's dead. So just get a web job." I'm like, "Oh, okay." So I got into web development. So I never touched
Okay.
Objective-C in a real project.
Yeah, fair enough.
So Swift came out, and that's when you kind of started teaching on your own, I guess. For someone who does a lot of educating others, how do you kind of learn on your own? How do you kind of pick up new skills? Do you just kind of build stuff out? Do you find books or videos or like what's kind of your learning
That's a great
style?
question. Not many folks ask me that actually. They just assume that I magic it out of my brain, I
Oh.
guess. And there's an element.
Like Paul knows
Well, no, that's obviously
everything.
not. I do not know everything, or even fractionally everything. I do try hard to dispel that view where I can. There are a number of ways I learn, and a large part of that absolutely is sitting down, opening Xcode, and throwing things at Xcode till I like it, right? And it's the worst way to learn in terms of results. Take a significant longer amount of time to get. You could have, someone could have told you, "Hey, do this," and you just do it. Now, well, obviously, versus, spending hours and hours and hours doing exactly the same thing. That's not great, but it does work. And for things like SwiftUI, where it was shipped with almost no documentation, bluntly, where no one else was using it yet because it was still day one, day two, day three. That was very, very hard. I had to figure things out as I went, and fortunately, I had booked a hotel room above WWDC, so I could wander downstairs and talk to folks and say, "Here's my thing. Is this right?" And they'd go, "Yes, yeah, it's right," or, "No, it's not right. Change it," whatever. And that was very, very helpful because the folks like Kyle Macomber or Nate Cook were instrumental in getting me pointed in the right direction very, very quickly because they were on the SwiftUI team at the time. And that was great. But obviously, that's not my preferred way to learn. That's a last gasp. I have no other choice. I go to, Apple's docs and there's no overview available. I have to try and figure it out. And that sadly is very common. I read a heck of a lot. I support other Swift authors. I buy a lot of Swift books every year. I must have 30 or 40 at this point. I've only read maybe half of them.
Nice.
I spend the money because I want to support people. Help their work and give them a help, but I've only actually had time to read maybe half of those, and I learned through that too. I by no means do I claim to have some knowledge other folks don't have. There are folks who are way better at things like Core Data or Combine or even UIKit than I am, and by buying their books, I will learn 10, 20 things from there. Absolutely, I do that as well. Normally, in a normal year, very much not this year, I would also attend events around the world where I speak, but also listen to lots of talks. And that is where folks show off what's interesting and new they're working on in their company. So you get lots of ideas and ask them questions and see their code. And of course, you meet attendees who bring their code to you and say, "Hey, here's my project. What do you think?" And, "Oh, this is really cool. Why do you think of that?" "Oh, yeah, whatever." Conversations all over the place. So I'm seeing vast swathes of code from other people that if you work for a company, by yourself, you wouldn't see. If I'm at 15 events a year, I'm seeing 15 sets of attendees, potentially 150 different projects a year from people saying, "Hey, check this out, check this out," plus talks, plus books, plus noodling around, plus live projects like Unwrap or Control Room or SitRep or whatever, written by me in Swift and SwiftUI. So it's a combination of many things, but it is absolutely not that I somehow just know things, because that is just not even fractionally true.
I think my approach is when you in Xcode programming out a bunch of stuff, and then what I've liked is if I'm not 100% sure on something, I'll just add a breakpoint, run it, and then it'll slowly, go through
Yes.
every little process. I'm like, oh, it's going way back into that thing. I didn't know that. So that's always been helpful.
Yeah, that's one way to figure out for sure. Obviously, it's quite intense, that it's quite slow. Often you can, you're pressing continue, 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 go, "Oh no, one too many, no!" And then you go through it again, and that's frustrating, but it all adds up. And at the same time, sheer experience. You know, when SwiftUI launched, I know some folks in our community won't say this, but it's absolutely true. SwiftUI inherits large numbers of ideas from React on JavaScript. It just does. Mm-hmm. And folks who claim otherwise are just flat out lying to themselves. And I had done React previously.
It's the same concepts, right?
Yeah, they're exactly. I had done both. React previously. And I, wow, this has got a lot in common. And rather than sort of fighting with how do I flip my thinking around for imperative declarative, and like, oh, this is like React and Swift. And so once you're able to have that prior experience, then it's a different hammer, but the same nail, if that makes sense. You know, the same solution, different language mm-hmm. around it.
Yeah.
And this is one of the helpful things about having a variety of languages behind you is you've seen some things before. You've been around the block a few times, Caleb. You've seen some disasters, seen successes, and seen some good ideas and a lot of bad ideas. But somewhere in there, hopefully, it's also some little nuggets you can take away and apply elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been... In my time in programming, I think I've seen where a lot of the stuff that comes out that is like, ooh, this is new and exciting, but it's generally... It seems like a lot of sometimes older ideas like declarative programming or functional programming, they've been around longer than React and SwiftUI, and I think Flutter's declarative, I think.
Yeah, exactly. There's no new thing under the sun or something, right? You know, there's nothing new under the sun. All the old ideas will come around again and be used again, and that's fine. That's perfectly fine. I mean, even the idea of functional programming, that's mm-hmm. kind of... Right, we've had that for a long, long time, but we forget about it because we've got object orientation and da da da, and it kind of comes around again, and that's fine. You know, there is no silver bullet, as Fred Brooks would say. There's no one magic way of doing everything, and we can try them all and see what works with our particular project.
So, a good understanding of the language, and then a kind of a broad understanding of programming concepts, and you can kind of start picking up anything.
I think so. I'd also say one of the helpful things about being at me. Is that I've got a lot of time in my hands. you know, when I was a full-time senior developer, I was running a team of 20-something people, right? And that meant doing stand-ups, meant doing one-to-ones, doing lots of emails, doing lots of Jira, doing lots of code review, lots of management presentations and similar, doing training and mentoring, recruitment. There's lots of things I was doing of which precious few were actually writing code. That is... fine, that's part of the job, right? It's what you want to be a senior developer for, to mm-hmm. have these kind of roles. But it means that now I'm not doing those things. I have significantly more time in my hands. And so folks say, oh, Paul, how do you have so much time? Because I'm not reviewing thousands of lines of code every week. I'm not doing, you know, Jira cleanup or whatever, fixing ancient bugs on iOS 10 in landscape on iPad in French or whatever obscure corner case you've got yourself into. I haven't got those problems. So I have significantly more time than a lot of people.
And especially if you're building out a very particular project to demonstrate something, it's very focused where, like, if you were working at a company, you know, like you said, you have to support French, you have to support this. You're building something that has to be a lot, it's used by a lot of people probably. So you have to build out a lot more to like a fully functioning kind of program.
Yeah, and that's the hard part, right? That's, I mean, anyone can knock together a quick Swift UI app very quickly and, you know, do something with it, and that's fine. It's the ultimate WWDC framework, I think, in terms of that result. But when you have to support a million users or 10 million users, or you've got 20 million in revenue behind you to look after, whatever, then you've got to do significantly more work to be stable, solid, whatever. Really plan things through in the big picture. And I don't. You know, when I make a watchOS app, you know, we're looking at a particular feature of watchOS. No, I haven't made this do networking, or I haven't made this have UI tests. Does that, I mean, no one cares because we're not talking about tests here. We're talking about something particular, feature of watchOS or whatever. And, and that's fine. That's where, actually, I'm doing a new course right now, the Ultimate Portfolio app, where we are trying to do everything in one app. And this means, you know, planning ahead, writing scalable code, writing flexible Swift UI code, writing tested UI code, and so forth. And that's, you know, a one-off for me doing, it'll be a very long series. It'll be about 100 videos of let's do everything. How do you do great testing? How do you do great accessibility or whatever in one app? And that isn't normal for me.
With the Ultimate Swift app, the Ultimate Portfolio app, why did you choose Swift UI over UIKit? I know we're now in 2021, but it's just the beginning. And I've had a lot of people ask me, like, well, would you do Swift UI or UI Kit? And I tend to go Swift UI, but I guess I think I've been kind of lucky that I've worked with smaller clients and I've been able to build apps from scratch, so I don't have to like look at old UI Kit code per se. And so I generally recommend, and I think Swift UI is getting adopted quicker than people think. So I had last year, I was doing a lot of job interviews and half the companies were Swift UI. Yeah. But I know a lot of people are still like, no, you should learn UIKit. Why do you think you picked Swift UI over UIKit for someone to build a portfolio app?
I think that, as you say, folks underestimate the remarkable speed of Swift UI's adoption. Even today, people say, oh, it's barely used, it's all UIKit. What they mean is the apps are on the App Store right now, because they're shipping for iOS 13 and 14, they're going to be UIKit, because there's a million of them right now. There's a lot of back catalog for UIKit, right? But I talk to huge companies, you know, Amazon, for example, they're saying, yep, we're doing Swift UI now, right? This is not just some people in their basement doing Swift UI. There's some serious big companies saying, we are now deploying new features of Swift UI, because it saves us so much time and testing and whatever. There's a cost saving to using Swift UI. And it isn't apparent necessarily. You go, this is quite fun, it's really fast. But take it further, what does that fast mean? When you can develop apps in a tenth of the time, where it takes care of the state flow for you, what does that mean for testing? What does that mean for reliability? And the answer is, it means you aren't doing most of the work you would otherwise have done. And so there are significant cost savings for Swift UI. And so it is expanding extremely quickly. And I think this year at DubDub will be the nail in the coffin. They'll announce new features of Swift UI, the final batch folks are waiting for, like, say, WebKit or alerts with text views or whatever, fields and sides, sorry. You know, the final folks really want to have in their apps. And they'll say, that's it. Mm-hmm. I am now shipping Swift UI across the board, because it'll be there, basically.
Yeah. For the past year, I've barely touched UIKit code. And the only reason I did is because one of the projects I had was a mix. But other than that, it's all been Swift UI. And clients, I think, are happy too. And they're like, let's build out this feature. You know, 30 minutes later, like, oh, is it something like that? Like, ooh. And they can see it really quickly.
Yeah. That's your mistake right there, Caleb. You want to say about 3 days later. two and a half days of playing games and 30 minutes of coding. But it's one of those things that it's like going back to Objective-C. You know, you've done so for a while and you go back to Objective-C and it's like table view, star table view, and it's like, what the heck's going on? And going back to UIKit, it's like, what? I've got to use viewdid load? I've got to use whatever, you know? It's like, wow, this is really strange and odd. And it's a jump.
Yeah, I thought I really liked UI stack views and stuff, but I was like, oh, there's a lot more to it than I get, like, just UIKit. Yeah, it definitely takes a longer to build out a UI.
It does. But obviously, you can do significantly more in UIKit even today, and you have complete control over performance in UIKit. You'd have nothing of that in Swift UI. You have complete control over, you know, exact animation movements and stuff, because you say do this and it does this. You don't do that in Swift UI. It's all declarative. And so I think folks right now are able to move to Swift UI because they say, well, actually, you know, if I do need that thing, if I need this extra little tweak, I'll just drop back to UIKit at that point. So they're doing UIKit on demand, I think, now, rather than doing it as a first choice.
And I think that's kind of something I've been saying, too, is that it's if you do build out, if you start with Swift UI, and like you said, this year could be the nail in the coffin, you know, everyone's going to start moving over. But even if you do start getting apps built and start getting things done when you need it, you can always go back and say, oh, actually UIKit has this and I can bring that in pretty easily.
Exactly, and it's all there. Now obviously UIKit is moving too, right? You know, UIKit isn't standing still. They're not bored in UIKit land. They're adding features galore every year, and that's important too.
Collection views the last 2 years,
they've been awesome. but it's you know, in iOS 13 it was huge, right? We had, you know, composable collection views, they were massive. But this year it was refinements to collection views to do lists. And like, well, do I really want that? Maybe. If they deprecate table views this year, perhaps maybe I'd want that. But I wasn't like saying, I must have that. Or they added the new UI action support for UIKit controls, like segmented views and buttons to do closure-based functionality. Again, it's nice, but it's not a killer UIKit feature. That's already in Swift UI. And so as the Swift UI team continues to grow, which it is, on all the platforms, and UIKit maybe eases off the acceleration a little bit with new features, it'll mean there's enough scope for SwiftUI to catch up and potentially overtake UIKit. Not this year. Catch up this year, maybe. Overtake, maybe 23? We'll see.
That'll be good. I'm always excited for it.
It's only 5 months now. I think, but...
It's like, oh, sweet. It's January. Let's count down now. It seems like more people, now that SwiftUI is out, they seem to be asking architecture questions, which I don't know if I'm... Like, I'm not super advanced in architecture. I'm really basic. I just stick with MVC because it seems to work just fine. But in my mind, like, SwiftUI is, you know, it's just the UI part. You can still kind of build the rest of the app and structure it a lot how you want. Have you changed, like, your thoughts on architecture in an app since you've got SwiftUI?
Folks really like, for all understandable reasons, really like to transfer their existing paradigms from UIKit to SwiftUI. And it was one of the most common questions I had in the early days was, how do I get my UIKit coordinators into SwiftUI? Because everyone was, you know, we all stole Suraj Kahnlu's amazing coordinator pattern, and that was fantastic in UIKit, and it's natural to want to put that in SwiftUI. Of course it is. It worked great in UIKit. It solved real UIKit problems too. And MVC, again, a battle-tested way of thinking from UIKit and other platforms, get in SwiftUI. And the answer is, it's complicated, because SwiftUI takes so much control away from you. You don't have as much direct control of what your code's doing at any given time. And I wrote recently, as part of the actually portfolio app course, that if I were to think about MVC from the perspective of SwiftUI, if I was trying to squeeze MVC into the SwiftUI box, what would it look like? And model's easy. Model hasn't changed. Model's your structs, your classes, whatever, store your data. That's fine. But the controller from UIKit land, the closest thing for me is a SwiftUI view. So a struct you've made that conforms to the view protocol, for me, is the closest thing to a controller in MVC terms. And that means we've got MC, like MC Hammer, right? The V, the remaining bit, we don't have. We have very little concept of views, even though it's got a view protocol, in SwiftUI. When we say a view, what we mean is list, for each, VStack, HStack, all the built-in SwiftUI stuff. And we build our own custom views. They're actually just wrapping around SwiftUI stuff. Make our own one, it's got text inside, that's SwiftUI stuff. Make our own shape, that we use rectangle or pass, that's SwiftUI stuff. We don't actually at any point have our own custom view being created. Mm-hmm. And it comes to, where do we put our functionality? Right now, the answer is, our SwiftUI views are like controllers. We put our code into our SwiftUI views to trigger the UI and update the UI and reflect it back in the model. It's doing the communication between the model and the SwiftUI framework. M is our model. The controller is our SwiftUI views, and the view is SwiftUI itself. That's, if I had to squeeze it in, that's how I'd do it. And that confuses folks all over the place. They expect, no, I want separate controllers. Well, why do you want that? That's not how they're designed to work. These are actually reactive, behavior, interactive parts of your code. They don't really work like static, dead views do. They're interactive and responding to behaviors. So MVC, you can squeeze in if you really want to, but I'm not sure I necessarily would try to.
Your model data, you're just observing as classes, and you're not using that really as a controller. Like the make a network controller that's observable, and then have it.
You could have a network controller as well. You can still have more controllers, a database controller, a network controller, if you want to as well. But nearly all your interactive functionality for handling user behaviors, triggering effects, will be inside your SwiftUI views, the ones you create. And that is not how MVC works. MVC, the view part, is for drawing data, not responding to actions, not handling functionality, not doing any interactive stuff. It's just there to draw data. And all the drawing, the actual drawing, is actually in SwiftUI. It's in UIKit, isn't it? Or CA core animation below UIKit. We don't do the actual drawing in our code ever. It's all declarative. And so it's a very, if you try and squeeze MVC in there, which I'm not particularly prone to do.
Yeah, I guess I didn't think of it that way before. It's interesting.
Well, the thing is, if you're doing UIKit, you honestly wouldn't, and you make a new custom UI view subclass, you wouldn't put functionality in there to run, to save data or anything. You just wouldn't do it, right? That, we know that's not how views work. Views are inert rendering tools. And that is exactly what SwiftUI is. We say, give me a VStack and a button and some text and a rectangle, gets rendered. We don't care where. It just happens somewhere else. The rendering is not our concern. It's somewhere else, not the framework itself.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So this is a fun part, even though like the fun part about podcasting and stuff or doing whatever is you can communicate with people kind of all over and get new ideas.
I'm not saying it's correct. You know, I've only been doing this for 18 months now, so there's still a fairly new framework. But that's that if you want to squeeze an MVC, mm-hmm. which you can do, it becomes MC. And I remember folks thinking it was MV, and it's definitely not MV. $8, you know?
Yeah. And like you said, I mean, the views are pretty much handled by Apple. We don't really, like, we can say certain things that we want, but yeah, it's they handle all the drawing. They handle a lot of things for us for views.
Exactly. So, even animations. Yeah. We can't actually make our own animations to do things. We just have to set up time and let the UI kit or app kit figure out what it actually means at runtime for us, which is both fun and also very frustrating.
Yeah. With the idea, like you've mentioned, how it takes a lot of how UI kit gives us a lot more control. Do you think it's better that Apple has more kind of control and we just kind of say, hey, this is how we want it to look, Apple. Now you draw it out for us.
I think once Swift UI reaches its full potential, it'll be better. But in the early days, it was you try and do something and it's like, this isn't quite working right, or it's very, very slow, or it's got a strange animation bug. And, you know, UI kit has problems too. UI kit isn't perfect. It's been refined over, 17, 18 years it's been existing for, a long time. But it's not perfect. But at least with UI kit, at any point you could say, hey, I know this isn't right, but if I subclass this thing and then override this thing and then it will work correctly, you know? So you could always hack your way around hiccups and issues and concerns. And that is significantly harder to do with Swift UI. You end up replacing things wholesale in Swift UI, which is not pleasant. And so I think right now when you hit a bug, like I've got a bug in the portfolio app, really frustrating. You show a screen, a correlated object, you can change any value of the ATX field and it'll pop the view controller off and go back to the root screen. And you're like, why? Why is it doing that? It didn't happen in 12.2, happened in 12.3. Why? And there's nothing I can do about it. I can't fix that. I can't override it. I wait for them to fix it. And that's frustrating because they've changed the behavior of how Swift UI worked from under my feet.
Yeah.
And I can't do anything about it.
Yeah. So while Swift UI might be speedier in general, in the long term, if you're more experienced, you can actually get a lot more done with UI kicks. You're not waiting on other companies. Or Apple,
basically. Apple have made a very strong commitment to version check every change with UIKit, or every meaningful change, so that, you know, when you build against iOS 12 and it looks this way, iOS 13 will say, well, it's built against iOS 12, I'll adopt the old iOS 12 behavior here, or iOS 14 will do iOS 12, and they keep that around for quite a few years. It'll break eventually, but there's stacks of version checks inside UIKit to restore and retain old behaviors so they don't break things going forward. Swift UI hasn't had that yet. And that's a sensible thing to have, because in the early days of Swift, you know, we're breaking this, that's fine. Crack on, break stuff. Just settle down eventually. And there's going to be, whether we think it's fair or not, this year will be Swift UI 3. And there'll be a community expectation. Listen, you've had your Swift 3 moment of things being broken. Let's now solidify what this should look like. It doesn't change again. And last year, it was additive only. Things only got added. They soft deprecated a handful of things, like some things he says, you know, we don't recommend you use this anymore. There are alternatives, but it doesn't warn you about it. It's not an actual real warning deprecation yet. But they need to start freezing things now. This is the behavior. This is exactly how it's supposed to work. It will always work like that. And that's partly, I think, a documentation issue. Like this thing here, do this, here's how it's going to look, and document that, it becomes law, it becomes just canon, that's how it works. And that isn't there right now because documentation is still a bit fragile for Swift UI, and so they can change things whenever they want to and say, yeah, that's the new behavior is correct.
Do you think they're doing a little better with their interactive Swift UI tutorials? They even did a newer one recently where they kind of build out like
yeah.
What is it, like an agile, a Scrum app or something?
They did. Yeah, I don't read them. They annoy me. And that's fine. They're not meant for me. You know, I was there doing the landmarks thing on day one at DubDub. I haven't done it before. You sort of scroll down a bit and you see a screenshot of a phone, a bit more, and see some code. Scroll down, screenshot, scroll down, code. And it's all done in very, very rich. As you scroll, the picture of the iPhone changes to code, then back to picture, back to code. And it was very, very clever to follow along while you're reading. But it meant that when I'm at the bottom and go, it was bindable object back then, before observed object came along. Command F, bindable, can't find it. But it was in, then search for it. And I go, oh, that's very annoying. That's not how my brain works. I want to absorb things quickly and refer back to it regularly. And so I wrote SwiftUI by example, full of the things I actually want to remember. Here's the things I found, and here's what they do, and these are correct. Obviously, I thought they were correct at the time, because that's the way my brain works. So I, even though it's not for me, I know it does benefit lots of other folks, that new cool tutorial style. So we'll see.
So one thing I was curious about, you know, you say you get a lot of books. When people went out to talks, you know, you do that and get a lot of information, and then you're basically sharing that information in your style. How would you suggest if someone else was like, well, Apple's documentation is lacking and I've read this and I've experienced that. How do you think people should, or any advice for people that are like wanting to share with like a book or a blog or video or some, or podcast even, something like that?
One of the things about learning that I think folks need to think about more, many, many things take a lot of passes to understand. And the classic example is a monad. What's a monad? And you can explain to someone about, you know, the three monad laws if you want to, and you can kind of say, well, it's like a burrito or whatever. There are many ways of explaining monads to people, and what will happen is they go, I don't get that, I don't get that, I don't get that, I don't get that. And they eventually say it's like a burrito, and they go, oh, like a burrito, oh, that's obvious, I get monads now. And they understand monads, and they can use FlatMap and feel really cool at these academic style meetups, and that's great. But it wasn't the it's a burrito thing that made it click. It was the seven previous failed attempts backed up by the eighth, just filling that last little jigsaw piece. And this is what makes diverse writing so important. Having a number of voices saying the same or similar sorts of things, because my style is built entirely around here are the things I want to read about in the way I want to read about them. And my entire business model, such as it is that I'm not a beautiful and unique snowflake. That there are people out there who learn exactly the same way as me and want to read in the same way as me. And that's my entire style. And as a result, if you are someone who does not way, if you want to have, I don't know, much more slow or much more theoretical, I don't know what, not my style stuff. That's basically most of the world. It's not me, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not that egotistical. Then having other authors that do suit you is great. Go and read Ray Wendlandt. Go and read Mark Moykins. Go and read Donny Viles. Go and read your stuff, Caleb. You know, there's a lot of options out there for folks who want to learn differently, and they're all valuable. And it's not that they'll read my thing and go, aha, I get monads or whatever it is first time. They'll get a little bit with me, a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and they kind of poke like a little chink in the puzzle, a little hole, and they can sort of see through it a little bit, and then someone else comes in and gives them a bit more and a bit more and a bit more, and eventually one clicks. And obviously I hope that's with my work, that I have given them enough different angles to explain a thing. But it's hard because Swift is a hard language. Swift's a super modern language with many, many advanced features like property wrappers. You know, they're complicated beasts. And so if you are thinking of writing and you're thinking, well, where's the point in writing? So-and-so has done it before. It doesn't matter. Go ahead and write your thing, because they'll read my thing, read someone else's thing, read someone else's thing, and read your thing. And your thing might be the bit that finally explains to them, aha, that's what optionals do. Oh, of course, that's how closure capturing works. Oh, that's what property wrappers are. Well, that's what result does. Whatever it is, add your own spin on it. And, you know, when I wrote this book last year, it's free online. It's called Understanding Swift, and it's based on all the questions I received, at least the most common ones, from folks who are doing the 100 Days of Swift UI. The same ones again and again and again and again. Why do we have to have int and double? Why can't we convert int to double freely? Yeah, they always all one here. And in there, I say, okay, here's my explanation of this thing. But by the way, if this wasn't good, a link to Antoine Fondelet. Go and read his stuff. You know, it's Swift Lee. It's a great site of this topic. So they can read a different point of view on the same thing. And hopefully it works. Hopefully I'm driving some folks his way, which is good for him. I'm giving folks extra points of books. It's good for them. So hopefully it kind of works out all there. You know, go and read from other people, basically. Go and read a variety of authors. So if you're thinking of writing, you'll go for it.
I know I've been switching between a couple different authors, going more in depth in Core Data lately, so that's been helpful. When everyone says Swift, I think they usually think iOS, but especially with SwiftUI to build across multiple Apple platforms, but also Swift on platforms beyond Apple. Are there any platforms like other than Apple's or even iOS that you're excited or interested in Swift?
I wrote a fair amount of Swift on server stuff using Katura, then Vapor, and also some generic cross-platform, cross-framework stuff like a graphics rendering library or a slug generation library for doing CMSs. And it's fun enough, but I just returned back to Apple's platform so very quickly. Because I kind of miss all the amazing frameworks. Oh, SwiftUI is very nice, but I'm thinking things like ARKit or CoreML or obviously UIKit itself or Core Graphics or SpriteKit or SceneKit or WebKit. Or there are some remarkable frameworks you get just sitting there for free. Mm-hmm. I keep thinking about, I should really go to Mac Stadium and get a Mac in the cloud. I can do Mac OS over the web, because I've written stacks of great Mac OS software in my time using Apple's APIs that I'd love to run on a server using my Swift code, using my PDF generation code, for example. It works on Mac OS natively. Putting that onto Vapor and Linux would be an absolute nightmare to do. I'd much rather have Mac OS doing that work for me, because it's just there, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I enjoy, I haven't had an experience in too much other stuff, but yeah, I'm pretty happy staying with the Mac for now. So one other question I have before I let you go, and with all the internet interruptions, what is one topic you would like to see developers talk about more? Like, you don't, something that the community could just talk about more than we already have.
Well, I've just helped launch the Diversity in Swift initiative on swift.org as a way to bring a wider range of voices into our community and to encourage them to take part and find friends, networking events, and more to build up more people and promote a wider range of voices. That's very important to me, and I think some of the work I've done with disability charities or Black Girls Code or similar, I think that's a repeated topic for me. I come back to again and again and again to try and raise money for, raise awareness for so many other kinds of folks who just don't look like me. Mm-hmm. That's the easy answer, though. I hope folks will be able to guess that one from me. If I was a sort of, I think, slightly more, less obvious, perhaps, what would I say that's less obvious? I'm one of those folks who really enjoys building apps for Mac OS and Watch OS. I really like noodling around Watch OS. It's a lot of fun because it's there all the time. You know, it's on your wrist all the time. And having the little digital crown is quite a lot of fun. Same for the Mac, of course, you're using it all the time, whether it's work, for coding or emails, whatever, Netflix, whatever you're doing, it's right there. So I love building for Apple's other platforms. So I wish there was more of those. That'd be really nice. Don't get me wrong, I love iOS. iOS is a great platform with a lot of fun stuff out there. It's great to build for, but I like noodling with other things as well. They're both fairly obvious, though, I think. They're both like pretty predictable for me as a developer. I'd go for one of those two.
Yeah. Well, they're good choices, especially the diversity one. I feel like, at least in the teaching space, there's like I think there's more diversity in blogs. Like, I've seen more women blogging than I've seen creating like videos per se. But I feel like in the iOS community, at least, a lot of the faces you see are men and typically, white men. You don't have a lot of diversity. Yeah. So I definitely would like to see that more.
We do, but yeah, as you say, in the speaking space or in the tutorial space, it's very limited. You've got, obviously, Erica Sadun's amazing. You've got Tamura James. You've got Kim Arnott. You've got, they keep keeping hired by Apple, which isn't helpful. Christina Fox is amazing. She's at Apple. They had Agnes Vashar. Hey, she's at Apple now. They had Nat Panferova. She's at Apple now doing SwiftUI. And so they keep snapping up people. Like Jasbo is now on tvOS at Apple, which is great. I'm really glad for him, but he was a brilliant speaker and now he's at Apple, so he can't speak anymore. And so they keep the best of our community, sadly, which is great for them, great for Apple, but we sorely miss them. I think
makes Apple a great diverse community, but then it leaves us lacking in people. Just the open source, the open community, I guess.
Yeah. And that's a challenging thing for them too. You know, they want to make sure they're getting the best and brightest they can. And that means hiring as aggressively as they can, I guess. So, yeah, it's great. It's great. I shouldn't complain. I'm very happy for Christina and Agnes and all the rest of them that are joining Apple.
Yeah. What do you think someone, like for people that are doing teaching or trying to get more involved in the developer community, I know you and Kaya Thomas and is it Christina Fox too that is on the diversity swift.org?
Yeah, so it's myself, it's Kaya, it's Christina, it's Niharika, and it's Holly.
Okay. What is it that you think we can do more to make it more inclusive? Because that's one thing I see on Twitter a lot. A lot of women that I follow, they post things and I just don't know how to respond because it's always like their experiences. They have like a really different experience than, you know, I've had in develop in tech, and I just don't know what we can do or anything. I don't know. Does that make sense?
I think I wonder whether sometimes we feel we ought to respond. We're obliged to respond. And actually, that isn't the case. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the reply guy thing can step in whether we mean to or not. Yeah. We want to help. And actually, they just want to just vent their feelings. And that's fine. That's important. You know, what I said to someone recently, one of the biggest mistakes I made when I was managing at first was when someone would say, "Hey, Paul, I've got this problem." I'd say, "Okay, here's how we can solve this problem." And often they don't want to have someone come in and suggest 10 things they've tried already. They want someone to say, "That's terrible. I feel sorry for you. This is awful. This is, we should try and do better." So first things first, I'd say, you know, don't feel obliged. You have to reply. And you know, one of the amazing things about the new Diversity in Swift group is we have these new Women in Swift forums. We have this new Black in Swift forum, and we hope to add more forums coming soon. Yeah. So they have a safe, known place they can post questions without fear of judgment out there. And I hope that will really prosper. Okay. The thing is, there are we think of our community as being particularly good, and I disagree. I don't think we're particularly good. In fact, I think we're probably below many, if not most, of the other communities out there, and in particular when it comes to inclusivity. And this shouldn't be the case, because I think of any community in the world, any coding community, I suspect the iOS one is one of the wealthiest out there, because you've got to have a MacBook or an iPad or an iPhone or whatever, right? The cost to entry is very, very high for Apple development. And so we have significantly more funding than, say, the Rust community. Mm-hmm. And they do some wonderful things in their site to encourage folks to be friendly and welcoming and so forth. And you know, I took my daughter to PyCon, a Python conference in Wales, like an hour and a half drive from here. And it was a full day of coding. It was Children's Day, the day just for children to come along to the event and have teachers come in and work with them and build things in Python and build things in Scratch and build things in code. Da, da, da. And they had other things going on at the same time. I was wearing the building, but it's lots of kids came to learn. And as a result, they had everyone who came anywhere to any part of the conference on any day, there was a guaranteed free creche, free childcare. Bring your kids, we'll look after them for you. We'll put them somewhere safe with registered childminders. They'll be safe, have games to play. It's included in the cost. Don't worry about it. Or if your kid's staying with you, we have guaranteed private breastfeeding rooms or nursing rooms, wherever you want to. There will be one at all times available for breastfeeding mothers, young mothers, to have at all times. They had, in every one of the lecture halls, they had sign language people at the front signing what was being said. They had live text-to-speech of what was being said on screens. You could read the screen or watch the signing. They had induction loops for people speaking, so they could have that as well. They had, you know, disabled wheelchair ramps on every staircase. They put so much work into kids, visual impairment, hearing impairment, mobility impairment. Everybody had the chance to come, and the cost was tiny. Yeah. And I made £20, $20, whatever it was I paid. Almost nothing to go to this event in a live building. And it, of course, included dietary requirements and a quiet room and a prayer room and blah, blah, blah. It was remarkable. And that's Python. Python is entirely open source. But they planned ahead. They have the experience. They have the background. They have the desire to make this work for everyone. And that is what we should be aiming for, yeah, as a bare minimum. Yeah. If we're the rich ones, we can go way beyond that. And I still see, I've been to events where it's in a very expensive country, where everyone who goes has already shelled out hundreds of bucks for a ticket. And then you get there, it's like, okay, we're going for a party. Everyone gets to come on a cruise with, you know, free drinks and whatever. And it's they spend their money on very, very expensive trips, yeah, that all these rich people already have because they're the ones buying tickets to come to the event. And I'm like, we don't need even more of these nice things. We're the last people in the world who need this. For everyone on that boat, you could give them away a diversity ticket to your event to help someone new come along who wouldn't otherwise be able to come along. You could have donated the money to charity. I run a charity event every year, and it raises $30,000 for charity each time, which is a significant chunk of change, quite frankly, particularly right now. So I get a bit annoyed that we're in this very, very privileged position. We have conferences that are very, very expensive, and then we don't actually include people effectively. So I think we're bad. we're particularly relative to what we ought to do. We are definitely bad.
Yeah, I definitely need to look into other, like you brought up the Python community, and the fact that they had sign language there was interesting because, like, you know, Apple does, especially now that it's all shot in a studio, you think they could add sign language or something for their talks. Because I heard that, you know, their yeah, new Apple Fitness, that at least they start out with a like they introduce everything with sign language, and I was like, that's something you could add to longer talks.
Yeah, there's all sorts Apple could do. And you know, a point Ash Furrow made a few years ago was that he was comparing Swift with the iOS platform with JS as a platform, mm-hmm, and he was saying that in the Swift world we feel like someone who is a tenant renting a house from a landlord, but Apple is a landlord. Yeah. And in JavaScript you own the house. And the underlying point he was making is that when something comes along, a problem comes along, we might try and fix it ourselves. We might say, hey, Apple, fix this problem for us, and wait for them to do it. I mean, look at Combine. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of folks want to use Combine. And Combine, they could have used RxSwift or similar previously. They chose not to. They jumped across to Combine very, very quickly. And there were other declarative frameworks they could use instead of Swift UI, but they chose not to because it wasn't as nice or as polished or whatever. Wait for Apple to do it and then jump to their thing very, very quickly. That's how our brain, how we're wired to work. And as a result, that actually expands into our community. You know, it's only like maybe 5 years ago when, or six perhaps, when you go watch a dub and it would be all men on the stage. Yeah. And they finally broke that. And now they work very, very hard to say, look, here's our VP for so-and-so, happens to be a woman, happens to be super smart. Get her on camera, put her, have her present her product she's worked the last X years working on. And that's huge. Mm-hmm. And it's led from the top, I think, to say, hey, we can all show off our diverse community. And there's still a lot more work to do. You know, the Swift core team is all male, for example, even today. Yeah. But hopefully it'll improve.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed a difference in WWDC videos over the years, but I don't know too much about, like, the actual teams. I do know, I think you or John Sandel talked to was it Holly, and there's another lady. They were building, like, the Grace, yeah, where they built out. And they actually did a talk together, I think, because they built out a lot of the Playgrounds app, didn't they?
They did. I was there. It was great. And that was a brilliant talk, because that had a killer line, which was, you know, what do we look like, Grace engineers? It's a great, great line. But anyway, that was particularly interesting because they've gone on stage wearing long dresses, high heels, and similar. And in nearly every dub before that, in fact, if not every dub before that, women wore fairly conservative clothes. I think I wouldn't confirm this, but I think it's because they broadcast it around the world to countries where women are required to cover their shoulders and similar. But they didn't for this one talk. It's one talk like ever, I think, in Apple's land. They have, you know, bare shoulders, long skirts, and high heels. And it was fantastic. You know, just go up there and dress however you want to dress. Whatever makes you feel happy on stage, just go and knock yourself out, you know? So that was a great talk. I was actually in the crowd for that, cheering, because it was a great, great talk.
Yeah, I think that's all good stuff, and definitely things I need to work on, because I know that I have not covered, like, accessibility. I've gone through a couple of your tutorials or articles and read through it, but I've never really demoed it or just even used it really in, like, client work, I guess.
The thing is, it doesn't take much. It really doesn't take much. I mean, if someone wants to make the very first step towards making their stuff more available for everyone, just start adding alt text to your Twitter images.
Yeah.
Like, just the smallest possible thing. No code required. Just show that you slightly care. And I actually get tweets from folks who are blind or vision impaired saying, thank you so much for adding a nice description to this thing. I really enjoyed it. And there was a really heartbreaking tweet last year from Jordan Castor, who's one of the WWC presenters, who is blind. And she said, if you're going to use a WWC hashtag, please add descriptions to your images. I want to see them too. I want to read them out and know what's happening in your pictures. And that's it. We all do exactly that. We all follow the hashtag and admire everyone being super excited about DubDub and Apple and Swift just 1 week of the year. And unsurprisingly, Jordan is too. She's just as psyched as we are, and she wants to see all the same things we do. So a little bit of me, and I know it's wrong and I feel cruel for it, but a little bit of me says, whenever someone tweets without an image description, I think, well, you're basically a jerk. You know, you haven't even taken a few seconds here just to add a bit of text describing the picture for the 5% of folks who can't read it easily. So it's wrong. I shouldn't judge folks like that, but I really wish more folks would describe their pictures, describe their videos. It's just a small, small thing to do.
I should look into that too. I don't think I post too many videos or photos, but...
Don't be a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, now the internet's finally working, but I think I asked a lot of the questions I was interested about. I'm glad we talked about accessibility and the community, because that's something I've been interested in lately, but it'd be interesting to learn more about that too. And I'm excited to see that you're working with Apple on the community diversity.org. And I noticed you were in the last iOS Dev Happy Hour, and I noticed even there was an individual who said, yeah, more work for accessibility.
Yeah, absolutely. The Diversity in Swift thing is just getting started. I'm really looking forward to seeing where it goes. We've got big plans, and right now we've started small. Let's get it moving. Let's get it, you know, going. We've had some great ideas submitted for new forums, new private groups there. Yeah, it's very, very exciting, and I really can't wait to see where it goes.
That's awesome. So if someone were looking for the Swift forums and your own content, where would they find you online?
Where they find me? I'm Two Straws, at TWO Straws on Twitter, on Reddit, on Stack Overflow, on GitHub, on basically everywhere, I think. Everywhere that matters, I think, I'm Two Straws. And I tweet a lot. I apologize to no one. I tweet a lot.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And everyone definitely check out hackingwithswift.com and Two Straws on all the social networks.